Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. I'm Samantha Lam, the host of this channel, and today we are going to be talking to Mark Vincent about his new book, Criminal Subculture in the Gulag, Prisoner Society in the Stalinist Labor Camps from 1924 to 1953. Thank you for being here, Mark. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure. So I am Dr. Mark Vincent. You can find me on Twitter at Vincent Criminal. Also got a podcast of my own, which is Cult of the Urca podcast. And I'm the author of an imminent publication, Criminal Subculture in the Gulag. I've been teaching also in the UK for a number of years. And so my interests are generally crime and punishment in the 19th and 20th century in Russia and the Soviet Union.
So what got you interested in this topic?
Well, it really was a film, actually, at the start. So there's a movie called Eastern Promises, which has Viggo Mortensen starring as the kind of central character. The film revolves around the Russian mafia in London. And the film's incredibly violent at the same time that I was, possibly enjoying like Quentin Tarantino style movies as well. But actually the rituals of the Vori, the thieves, the gang of mobsters who are in London in this movie got me interested in, at the beginning, the tattoos, but as that went on, more of their different behaviors and how influential, I suppose, they were as well.
So when most people tend to think of gulag, they tend to think of political prisoners a la Solzhenitsyn, not really criminals like the Vori. So how much of the gulag was populated by political prisoners and how much of them were traditional criminals?
Well, it really is quite a small fraction of both of those two groups. I suppose that we have an understanding of political prisoners through a pantheon of memoirs that is created, and in those memoirs there's a very strong presence of criminal gangs, but actually the majority of people who are incarcerated, at least in the period that I'm looking at, are actually just kind of ordinary people who are sentenced for what is regarded as kind of everyday life crimes, turning up for late if you're working in a factory, for example. So despite the fact that we have an understanding of the criminals and the politicals, this very strong binary of the two groups, the majority of gulag inmates actually come from what's normally like considered just a kind of an ordinary background.
Were there differences in the way these groups were treated? I know you're particularly looking at the Vori. Were they treated differently or more harshly than non-Vori prisoners in the Gulag?
I think, if anything, they probably have a much more lenient time. I think there is a very curious relationship between the authorities and these criminal gangs that form. And for the most part of my book, at least up until the Second World War, they're not quite the Vori in the way that we understand them. They're more just kind of ad hoc gangs who come together through, you know, like if they're from the same city or the same street even, or if they're incarcerated for similar crimes. I think those gangs get that, you know, that the agency that they have because of the lack of staffing in a lot of regions. So there has to be this kind of balance between what the authorities and what the guards can do in terms of monitoring the prisoners, and in order to control prisoner society, they give a little bit of leeway to these criminal gangs. So I think if anything, they perhaps get away with a lot that they probably shouldn't.
Well, it does seem, I mean, my research is collective farms, but that understaffing, lack of resources is sort of the, you know, mark of the Stalinist era. Nobody had enough people to effectively monitor anything. And so as long as no one was doing anything incredibly terrible, you know, small crimes such as, you know, embezzlement, drunkenness and stuff were often overlooked.
Absolutely. I think, and this is why we don't see any large scale uprisings in the Gulag until it really peaks in terms of prisoner population and following Stalin's death in 1953 and the amnesties as well. I think that this equilibrium is kind of maintained reasonably well up until that point.
So were there any other factors that paved the way for the growth of organized crime and the rise of the Vori within the political or the penal system?
I think the Second World War is absolutely crucial to what happens with the development of the organized crime groups afterwards. So what we have at the start of the Second World War, fairly obviously, is large numbers of prisoners going off to fight on the front lines in penal battalions. I think I'm right in saying it's about 1 million prisoners leave the camps to go and participate. And so what happens on their return is that the prisoners who have left to fight in these battalions are met by recidivist criminals who've stayed inside the camps. And that cooperation with the regime and fighting, you know, in the Red Army and for the Soviet Union brings these two groups into direct conflict. And that's where we really see the kind of birth of the Vori. That's a very strong foundational myth for them, comes through this war between different criminal gangs because of participation or non-participation in World War II.
So how did the Vori start defining themselves? You said initially that was basically Zimlachistva, people from similar areas who just sort of grouped together for survival. How do they start transforming into, you know, this caste of organized crime, Russian mafia we think of today?
So I think when we have this divide, this fracture in terms of criminal kind of recidivist society, and the different groups start to tattoo themselves in various ways to indicate the factions that they belong to. So we have the Vori and other kind of splinter groups from the Vori, names such as the Departed, and so on, and then opposing them we have the Bitches, the Suki, and so both of these groups begin to tattoo themselves to indicate that they are part of one group or another. And this is where we see a change in the tattoo culture from really being the codified part of tattoos up until that point had been more to indicate if you were an arsonist or if you were a bandit or a criminal profession that you claimed as your speciality. So with the Second World War, we see this fracturing, and that is reflected in the tattoos of the prisoners from immediate post Second World War period onwards.
So what kind of tattoo culture existed pre World War One or World War Two? I mean, was there a czarist tattoo culture among criminals?
Well, so I was going to follow up on that by saying that there is actually one that's pre World War One, and there is a kind of czarist tattoo culture, and some of the criminologists in the early 1920s are writing about this, and Also, we can go even further back, and some of the reports of Sakhalin Island talk about the tattoos as well. But those late imperial tattoos, those pre-World War I tattoos, they have more of an aesthetic focus. So a lot of them are satirical, but also some of them are essentially rip-off versions of famous paintings. So the most popular artist for prisoners to have tattooed on them is Vaznetsov. So with the images of the medieval knights.
Yeah, they're from Kirov.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
we have the museum for the Vaznetsov brothers right here downtown.
Oh, okay. Wow. No, I didn't understand that. I spent a lot of time staring at Vaznetsov paintings and then replications of it on the chests of prisoners.
I wonder if it's because Viatka was a place of exile. I mean, a lot of prisoners ended up here, even in the Tsarist period, as either exile or on their way to Siberia. I mean, we ended up with people like Gertsen, Soltykov, Shchedrin, and then a bunch of less famous people who got treated a whole lot worse.
Yeah, sure. No, I think there could definitely be something in that. I mean, Viatka is the name that pops up regularly in the work that I do. So it would be fascinating to try and find out. So what we have is the development from the 1930s onwards of a tattoo culture, which is a bit more varied than had existed as far as we know in the late imperial period, in the period of the Soviet Union, the 1920s. So from the 30s. According to memoirs and some other evidence that we can find, this is when tattoos start to become more of a passport, into criminal and prisoner society, and they also start reflecting the Soviet regime directly. So we start seeing images of Lenin and Stalin appearing, and other famous propaganda images. So the one that I use most often is Dmitry Moore's enlistment poster from the Civil War. So with the growth of the Soviet regime and with the higher numbers of incarceration, fairly obviously, during the purge years, we see that tattoo culture becomes a lot bigger, and the tattoos take on a whole load of different meanings. The aesthetic part of it kind of remains, as does the almost the romanticism, people getting tattoos of their estranged lovers and so on, but it certainly becomes a lot more professionalized and linked directly to a growth of criminal culture during the 1930s, and then that again takes another leap during the 40s and with the wider events that are happening.
Just out of curiosity, how are they doing these tattoos? Is this like sharpened pins or?
With whatever they can find. I mean, most popularly is notebook wire. So I think in a lot of memoirs refer to notebook wire being used, but basically like anything they can get their hands on. The sociologist Irving Goffman describes this in one of his books from the 70s as make do's. So really anything that will work, and I'm sure a whole load of things that don't work out particularly well either. But the one that I tend to always go back to is notebook wire, and they use the soles of the boots as well, which are burnt to make the ink.
Because tattoo machines do actually exist during World War II, because the Nazis used them.
Of course, yeah. And I think I'm kind of fascinated by the slight interplay between the stuff that I do and certainly the recent boom in popular fiction regarding tattooing and Auschwitz and how the Nazis used the use tattooing, and of course you're right, they have the equipment to do it, but certainly in the Gulag it remains something which is technically illegal, but it, like a lot of things that happen inside the zone, it continues to happen regardless.
Well, technically illegal in the Soviet Union and in Russia just means it's fine till you get caught.
Absolutely.
So were there any other behaviors other than tattooing that they used to identify themselves as members of a certain group, as Vori or
My book is actually ordered in terms of the different behavioral rituals. So go into quite a lot of detail about the initiations and so that you know the types of tests that people are put through to prove their kind of loyalty in, you know, in the group. And a lot of the time this is just a kind of mastery of verbal techniques to show their dominance over other prisoners, or just kind of straightforward fighting. Actually most of the time that helps prove your worst to the gang and impresses the Pakhan, the boss. I then in the book talk about the importance of tattooing, but I've actually got a chapter of visual and verbal communication together. So I look at the tattooing as the visual part of that, and the slang which develops as the verbal part. So a kind of mastery of the slang. Not just the kind of general slang that we now know from Solzhenitsyn and so on, but often there are different layers, you know, going right down to a kind of language that will only really be understood amongst that specific gang that's using it, and it still remains fairly secretive.
So where would you find this recorded? Because most of these people are now dead, so you would have to find it in some sort of archival form. Who would have recorded prisoner slang?
Well, most prominently, Jacques Rossi. So Jacques Rossi is a prisoner who's reasonably well known. He's not he's not in the kind of top five gulag inmates. You know, that would still be Solzhenitsyn and Ginsberg and so on. But Jacques Rossi actually publishes a gulag handbook, which I believe I'm right in saying comes out in the 70s. So Rossi records slang from his experience in the 40s and in the 50s. There are also dictionaries of slang which exist in the late imperial period in the 1920s. There's a bit of a gap actually in the 30s, and again fairly obviously there's a lot of dictionaries of slang which emerge with the growth of more organized crime in the 80s and 90s. So I've used a lot of those dictionaries. Memoirs where I've been able to publish and unpublished, so I've kind of benefited from the some of the Memorial Society archives. So the real answer is a whole load of different places. it's quite a patchwork, quite a mosaic to at least put that part of it together.
How do you, as a non-native speaker, figure out that this is slang? Because some of these words are, you know, otherwise normal words. Like, I have some interesting Russian friends. You know, one of them told me, like, pituch, you know, of course, it's a normal Russian word for rooster, but it also apparently, I guess, is somebody who is sodomized in prison.
Yep, of course, yes.
So how would you figure that out when you don't have the cultural context?
I mean, personally, I try to cross-reference everything as much as possible. But again, the most honest answer is I bombard my Russian friends with emails and ask them to help me out with it as well. Like as a non-native speaker, and also different generations. You know, mm-hmm. So I have a variety of different Russian friends. But actually, my Russian translator from the UK who grew up in Moscow. Who's in her 60s now. She's my kind of go-to person, Veronica Balka, who's a wonderful translator in her own right. I have to be quite resourceful, I think, in the way that I use friends or kind of wider contacts, and a lot of the time you can find the slang leaves the camps as well. We have a revolving door in the gulag of 20% of prisoners leaving every year, even at the height of the terror. So quite a lot of the language, as I'm sure you're aware, ends up just kind of being part of what we might term as like colloquial Russian. especially with people like Vysotsky and his popularity, and to the to the point where now people have picked apart parts of Putin's speeches and drawn out words and phrases that come directly from either criminal society or more directly the gulag.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, I mean, English has phrases like that, like punk was actually equivalent to B2 initially. but I know that the language changes a lot. Like my students even now have trouble with Pelevin and sort of 1990s slang because that makes me feel very old. I'm like, oh, God, guys, you weren't even born in the last century. I mean, it is an issue. I have trouble sometimes even with kolkhoz slang just because it's isolated for me by culture and time.
You know, and knowing how, like, it as detailed as I can go into researching, and as many people I can ask. I suppose this is the same for you as well. We can't know how two people in the 1930s will use this slang and interpret it. You know. I think it is just an understanding of Russian linguistics, which is very very helpful, and which for me was one of the most difficult things to do when I was starting my PhD, and which subsequently turned into the book. A lot of common sense as well, like you said, from spending a little bit of time in Moscow, I began to figure out where different slang words might fit into kind of more general conversation or, environments they might be used in. I started hearing words in bars in Kitai Gorod, and I kind of figured it out from there.
So any interesting slang you want to teach our listeners?
I'm always quite bad.
That's kind of the fun part, though, isn't it?
Yeah. You'll have to get back to me on that one. I'll maybe drop some slang in the remainder of the interview.
Or they have to buy your book to find out.
Yes, I mean, there's a lot of slang in there.
So how did the Vori establish and maintain hierarchies within within their own groups and within the penal system itself? I mean, I assume violence was a part of this, but any other ways?
Well, they have their own internal group hierarchies. So the internal group hierarchies are very similar to probably a lot of familiar like criminal groups from film and TV. So you have a leader who is most often referred to as the Pahan, the boss, and then will delegate down to Shestyorki, so sixers, they're kind of lackeys. And then under that you have a large number of other gang members who are kind of, for want of a better expression, all kind of squabbling and vying for position and to prove their worth and their loyalty to the boss, to the Pahan, but also to the group in a more general sense.
Is this a family-like structure like the Italian organized crime, or is this more like you would see from like South American gangs?
I would say more South American gangs. I make the comparisons in the book of U.S. gangs and and South African prison gangs, so the numbers gangs in South Africa. But yeah, like extremely vertical, and not defined by familial ties in the same way. I think that's a very big difference between the Russian mafia, or, you know, the Vori and the Sicilian mafia. In terms of the hierarchy and the structure.
So how did fellow prisoners who were not part of the Vori deal with having this, you know, highly centralized, very violent element within camps? Did they try to avoid them? Was there a lot of conflict between Vori and non-Vori?
I was surprised by the fact that there wasn't more. Like, I think the other prisoners definitely understand to stay out of their way, and at times they don't have much choice in that, especially on some of the some of the voyages and the penal transportation. But actually, from what I've found, and this is probably not a great expression, the other prisoners become certainly in the kind of post World War II camps collateral. You know, like the main violence actually still occurs within the gang itself, in terms of internal discipline and punishment, or in regards to what I was talking about earlier, in the war that develops between different gangs. And there is violence at times which is directed towards the guards and other staff of the camps, but actually in looking at the different accounts of violence perpetrated by recidivist criminals, by criminal gangs, it's mainly towards their kind of own, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the 1990s gang wars in the US, and that was actually very similar. Other people who got injured were simply caught in the crossfire.
It is very territorial, you know, like, and there's a lot of excellent work on Russian gangs, Svetlana Stevenson's book, which was published a couple of years ago. And there is a huge, huge amount of interplay between the gangs that Svetlana talks about in the 90s and the 2000s, and the gangs that I look at in the 1920s, 1930s, and, you know, into the 40s. So I think it is the gangs that I look at dominate certain areas of the barracks. And they have complete agency over the prisoner transportation process at times. But certainly the gangs that I look at, they know what they can get away with in some areas and not others. So, for instance, that when they get taken to the work site, there is very little violence that occurs there, because as soon as it does, then the chances are that they're going to be shot by guards. So it is incredibly territorial.
So how does this violence affect the camp and colony personnel too? Because you said they were understaffed. And do they grant concessions to the Vori to avoid violence? Or are they very strict? Because, you know, the normal person thinks of the gulag as, you know, you put a toe out of line and something truly terrible happens to you.
I think they allow the criminal gangs, and the leader of the gangs, if you're reading through the memoirs, will often have the most say in this. There'll actually be a link between the staff, at least the low level staff, and the criminal authorities, and sometimes this will involve running the black market. In a way which the staff and the high-ranking prisoners are directly linked. But I think that the general approach of the authorities is to allow the dominance of the gangs in some areas, because that won't then, in theory, turn into a large-scale uprising. And also the biggest concern to the authorities is still the political prisoners and the spread of subversive ideas in the way that they look at it. So they see the criminal gangs as being kind of, socially close, or in terms of their potential redeemability. So they allow them concessions, again, for want of a different expression for it, because that allows them to reach their or to get closer towards their overarching goals in terms of what the camp authorities want from the labor camp system.
So do the Vori participate in any of the re-education programs? Because I know the political prisoners were often not really supposed to, but they occasionally did. And that the Gulag did actually offer things like theater circle and football. I can't really imagine Russian mafia doing, the Nutcracker, but...
No. Well, I'm just going to highlight it. There's a very good article by Stephen Maddox on football in the Gulag that I read recently. I do look at some of these activities. So a lot of the information that I found about the labor camps of the 1920s comes through the prisoner newspaper. But overwhelmingly in the 1920s, it's what we describe as political prisoners who are participating in the prisoner newspaper and also in the theater, to the point where the prisoners from a more of a kind of recidivist working class background get very frustrated and actually start writing complaints to the newspaper that their voices aren't being heard in it. There's also a theatre company, Solovki on the Solovetsky Archipelago, which is formed of Svayi. So kind of like this is a term for like our own in terms of from being a working class recidivist background. So there is a partial corroboration between the kind of recidivist groups that I look at and the re-education programs, but actually a lot of the time especially when we get later into the 1930s, the criminals I'm looking at, they're more likely just to refuse to take part in any work duties and any cultural educational activities whatsoever, because they still in terms of criminal society they still see it as collaborating with the regime, which is their most strongest kind of tenant in terms of criminal and recidivist society is collaborate with the authorities, basically. So the real answer is that it's very complicated. There is partial evidence, but certainly it doesn't work. Like the attempts by the regime to get the recidivists to take part in it, on a large scale, it's pretty unsuccessful.
That leads me to my next question about work refusal. It's commonly accepted that refusing to work carried grave punishment, both inside and outside of the gulag. Inside the gulag, it could get you stuff like reduced rations, trip mm-hmm. to the isolator. But the Vori, as you said, don't want to cooperate with the Soviet government. So how do they react or circumvent being punished for refusing to work?
So a lot of the time they accept a trip to the isolator, and you can read a lot of accounts from where other prisoners have ended up being, almost like punishment compounds with a lot of, criminal recidivists. They kind of accept that if they don't want to work, then they'll take the punishment, they'll take the hit for it. Other than just accepting that if you're not going to work, you're just going to get thrown into an isolator, there is a lot of hypocrisy in it as well. I mean, there are lots and lots of memoir accounts which do show that that what I might term as criminal recidivists are taking part in work activities, despite the fact that it's their kind of number one rule to not work for the regime. So
is that because they get more food and in some cases a chance for earlier release?
I think it works on a really. It depends on how that camp functions, and even that sub department of the camp sometimes. Yeah, I think the most important thing to remember is that, as for all prisoners, the criminal recidivists are trying to survive, but what they often create is a kind of alternate route to rations, because they can steal it from other prisoners. They can have that. They can. they can trick other prisoners into playing cards against them, and then cheat, and then take their rations and take their jacket and so on. So I think it really does depend on the situation at that particular camp at that particular time as to how the criminal gangs behave. I think that from what I've seen in the memoirs, this is another fairly obvious point, is they're quite streetwise. And they will figure out ways to circumvent the system.
Well, it's just very Russian in general.
Well, yeah. I think you could say that about a lot of prisoners around the globe.
Oh no, I don't even mean prisoners. I mean my kohozniki are masters at not doing what they're supposed to.
Yeah, of course. And the wider things that we see in Soviet society, personal connections, mm-hmm. Swindling the boss. This is all taking place. Tufta is this is all taking place in the Gulag as well.
Getting them to turn a blind eye to you basically running private industry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you talk a little bit about gambling, and you sort of use it as a sort of a micro history of prison life. Why was gambling important, and how did playing cards reflect larger realities? Why do you focus on it in the book?
I think in terms of prisoner society in the Gulag, it helps to fix the inmates in different categories and different positions through the card playing. The criminal gangs, high ranking criminal figures are able to kind of show their dominance. So this is not just about stealing rations off of one prisoner who's essentially being duped. It's more about the audience of it as well. It's quite a kind of Foucauldian concept, I think. But the message to the audience of the authority of the gangs. This is all played out through these different card games. So I think that the biggest thing is it shows the control over prisoner society that the recidivist groups have.
So in many ways, it's political theater like show trials.
It's absolutely theater. I mean, it's this the gangs that I'm talking about also hold their own trials, and there's a chapter of my book dedicated to it, in which they will have entire court scenes played out in the barracks. They will have three judges, and they'll be supporting evidence given as to whatever the crime is that the person on trial has perpetrated. So they are directly mimicking the judicial process and the Moscow show trials, the case of Comrade Pavlik. Russian history has a very long tradition of these visual forms of punishment that exists, mm-hmm. Right up until today with the more recent trials of Magnitsky and Pussy Riot. It's absolutely for the benefit of the audience. As a lot of prisoner society is, the micro movements, even the tiniest word or gesture, suggestion, they can mean so much more because of that particular situation within the barbed wire of the labor camp.
And what happens to these people who are members of these warrior societies once they're released? Do these criminal subcultures continue to influence their lives upon release? Are they mostly recidivists? And does this lead to the creation of some sort of criminal class?
Well, there is a lot of concern with the amnesties in 1953 about a cult of criminality forming. So, and there's a wonderful film, Cold Summer of 1953, which is very explicit in the potential dangers of these amnesties and large groups of recidivists kind of running havoc in the countryside. So following the amnesties following Stalin's death, there is a very high rate of recidivism. A lot of the prisoners who are released, the non-political prisoners who are released, end up back in the camps quite quickly. you know, quite often they'll be arrested at train stations, you know, kind of singing songs like against the regime, or, you know, taking part in criminalized activities. There's a wonderful book by Alan Barenberg on Vorkuta, which talks about the problems caused by criminal gangs, essentially following the amnesties in 1953. They really do just filter off all over the place if they don't end up going back into the camp system. The camp system, of course, has shrunk quite a lot at this point. And also, criminal subculture starts entering the mainstream through Vysotsky, and you know, other kind of popular singers during that time. So, it's a complicated picture that we do start to then see the growth of organized crime gangs from the 70s onwards, and that's when the Vori really do come to the forefront. Of life in the Soviet Union, the 80s and the 90s, and leading to the images that I think we're all very familiar with, during the Yeltsin period and the dominance of the mafia during that time.
So, do people end up becoming recidivists because of the restrictions placed on them as former criminals? Because I know, for example, a lot of the political prisoners get out with really serious restrictions about where they can live, what kind of jobs they can have, if they can go to educational institutions or not. Or is it because the people have become sort of invested in this criminal culture?
No, they do suffer the same restrictions. You know, the 101 kilometers, I think it is, and the regime cities that certain people are not allowed into. So there is a real problem with being able to travel around afterwards, in a very similar sense to what happens with some of the quote unquote like political prisoners, some of the people who write memoirs. Ginsburg ends up staying after her sentence, and she kind of forms a life for herself in the same region, largely that she's been incarcerated in. And I think this is the same for a lot of the criminal recidivists. They're large expanses to travel. you need resources to do it.
Are they given passports? Because collective farmers don't get passports till the 1970s unless they go through a whole series of applications through their collective farm and then the rural Soviet, and they have to go to certain predpriyaty enterprises. And that makes it difficult for them to travel. Are former criminals denied passports?
I don't know if they're necessarily denied. I don't think they really, a lot of them really, seriously... invest in the idea of having passports. I think that the networks that they've formed inside the camps largely continue afterwards, and I haven't found much in terms of the passportization process. And I've generally followed the bad people in the camps who continue to be bad people afterwards, if that makes sense, and not the ones who then attempt to re-enter society. So we don't, I certainly haven't found recidivism in our understanding of it now, and people becoming reformed and entering back into society, because it's easier for me to follow arrests and so on in terms of what's left behind for me as a researcher. So it'll be really interesting to go into that. Actually, what I'd love to do. This book ends in 1953 with the death of Stalin, and has a little epilogue. But the project that I'm working on now goes a lot further into the 60s and the 70s. So I think that the passportization, part of what I've done in the past could definitely be developed much further.
Okay. So what do you think overall your book adds to sort of the general field of Gulag studies, which does tend to be pretty heavily focused on political prisoners?
My best answer is that there isn't another book like this. This is filling a really kind of huge gap in the scholarship. Not only that, it's It's the only book, at least, you know, the only book that exists in English to consider criminology and penology and sociology. You know, I've tried to bring in a lot of my different influences. You know, I'm someone whose previous, you know, like projects prior to this have all revolved around organized crime and criminality in some form. So I've brought a lot of things over from different disciplines, you know, and if anything, it's reading up on you know, how to use memoirs and how to get around the Soviet part of this and the late imperial part, you know, in terms of what I've done in an introduction to, you know, to my book. But what I think ultimately is that, and hopefully this has been achieved in the book, I guess I'm going to find out when people read it, is to bring the 49ers. So the you know, rather than the 58ers, which is anyone who's read, you know, a handful of Gulag memoirs, or not even that, you know, the kind of secondary sources.
So
as
you're referring to the Articles of Criminal Code that they're sentenced under, just for our listeners, if they don't know what a 49er is.
Yeah, no, so 49 is the essentially a code for recidivism in the 1920s, and actually at Solovki, the you know, the famous camp on the Solovetsky archipelago, prisoners were referring to themselves or having this label given to them by others as well, you know. So I think what has been overlooked in the past is that despite the fact that we know a lot about the 58ers, the other groups are also known by their particular, you know, criminal code designation as well.
And so, 58 is counter-revolutionary agitation, right?
Yes, which is what the majority of memoirists are incarcerated under. I mean, that is in it. Like, the problem with using any criminal code is that they're always open to a massive amount of interpretation. And they're very broad. So I've tried to bring the 49ers, so the you know, the kind of criminal recidivists, more into view, you know, and in an attempt to hopefully encourage other people to look at different groups of nationalities, you know, who are obviously imprisoned under at times different codes as well. The real kind of biggest thing that I discovered from reading a lot of memoirs, especially in Russian, is that these different codes, these, you know, 49ers, 35ers, 58ers, I mean, that's how prisoners and the authorities you know, like, used to refer to each other in the camps. And I don't think that's been emphasized as much as it could have been in previous work on the Gulag.
Okay. So thank you for being here. Maybe you'd like to tell us what you're working on next.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm working on a tattoo project. So tattoos are part of my book on criminal subculture, but actually the publication I'm working on at the moment deals directly with an archive of drawings. So anyone familiar with the Russian Criminal Tattoo Encyclopedia that has been put together by a company called Fuel Publishing based in London will know that the drawings of these tattoos, they all come from one guy who was allowed access around a lot of camps throughout his 30-odd year career in the Ministry of Internal Affairs. So I'm working on a publication which looks directly at that archive. And that should be coming out at some point next year.
Well, that sounds very interesting. I'd like to thank you for coming on the podcast and showing this new aspect of Gulag studies to us. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.